I'm Richard, and welcome to Acid Torque's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of February 24th, 2014. Join us this week as we talk with Marc Chevalier, historian of the Oviatt Building, about debunking myths and bringing LA's past back to life. We'll also visit with Terrence Egan, who is restoring Henry Huntington's century-old faux bois, artificial wood, arbors in the Huntington Gardens to learn about this nearly lost art form and the process of collaborating with a long-dead anonymous master craftsman. So stay tuned. Los Angeles.
El Pueblo. Lotus Land. The City of Angels.
The Day of the Locust. The slide area, where all the fruits and nuts ended up when they turned the country on its ear.
But you and I were born here, and don't mind a few oddballs in the mix.
They add flavor. Growing up in Cheviot Hills, my compass pointed straight to 5th and Main.
As a kid in Hollywood, I was forbidden to take the bus to the Central Library, but I did it anyway.
Because you've got to start at the center to understand this confounding and fantastic city.
Which makes nonsense of history and breaks all the rules.
Rainer Banham said that.
He taught us well.
In the 1980s at UC Santa Cruz, now on our tours and in our time travel blogs, we're continuing the conversation.
Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles and Charles Bukowski's The Birth of Noir, Route 66, the lowdown on downtown, the real Black Dahlia.
Positive public space, endangered landmarks, forgotten lore,
memory maps, mysteries, murder,
the allocation of resources,
the hidden forces that shape public policy,
Skid Row,
Bunker Hill,
preservation,
restoration,
redevelopment.
It's a four-letter word.
Los Angeles. You can't eat the sunshine, but you can drive around and take a long, hard look.
And listen to the stories.
And pass them on. Why are we doing this again?
Because we love the place with a passion that goes beyond sense or reason.
So did Rainer Banham.
So we did. Now let's begin.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. Sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Brooke Shears, Dairy, Angela Savvy, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline for la la la. You can't eat the sunshine.
Welcome everyone to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of February 24th. 2014. I want to welcome you once again for another week of exciting interviews. This week, our two interviews will be with Marc Chevalier. He is Lava Visionary 2014. He's a great Los Angeles historian, and he's going to talk about research methodology and debunking myths and bringing lost Los Angeles to life. We're going to talk with Terry Egan. Terry Egan is an independent contractor, not affiliated with the Huntington Library as an institution. I promised the PR department I would say that, and I'll say it again before his interview. Terrence is an independent contractor restoring the faux bois arbors in the gardens. These are Henry Huntington's beloved ferro concrete arbors in imitation of old oak. Very interesting. Really important interview, the first of many interviews on the true nature of mortar. Kim Tipjar.
You're referring to what you call the Pishka, and I call it the digital tip jar. It's associated with this podcast, and if you enjoy what we do, and you're so inclined, you could go to the podcast page and throw a little something into said digital tip jar. We are always grateful for the contributions of listeners. They help fund our excursions into Southern California to find people for you to listen to. Never obligatory, always appreciated, and thank you for listening.
Okay, Kim. Closely watch trains. We've just got a couple today, so let's start. 5th and Hill. North.
Olive.
Oh, thank you. 5th and Olive, northwest corner.
It's a short block.
It is. It's not that short.
All right.
Northwest corner. Northeast corner. 5th and Olive. Right, looking
out. Kitty corner to the Biltmore.
That's right. Looking out the Olive Street entrance to the Biltmore, you see the parking lot. Okay, well, it may not be a parking lot for long. The former location of Hazard's Pavilion, the former location of the old Philharmonic Auditorium, which has been vacant since 1986, which is 28 years. It may... I had to look at my notes. I'm sorry.
Keep going.
I got confused between doing the math in my head and looking at my notes. It's going to get...
Supposedly.
Right. Okay. Some new development. 5-0 is the name. I like that corner. I think about that corner a lot. So we're keeping an eye on this corner.
Residential, kind of a 60s-looking glass wall apartment-style complex. Looks like something that might be down in Wilshire, Westwood Way. Kind of underwhelming. Not really what I would expect to see on such a prominent location, facing onto Pershing Square. But, you know, I know no one is making good Art Deco architecture in Los Angeles anymore.
Exactly.
It's sad.
Kim, Rufus apparently is okay. Rufus of Bahuka fame, the owners...
Right. For anyone who didn't listen last couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot about Rufus, the carrot-eating paku fish at the former Rosemead Tiki Bar, Bahuka. Rufus has been alone in the dark for the last year. The tiki community found out he was actually still inside the shuttered restaurant and that the owners wanted to get rid of him toot sweet. An attempt was made to find a new home for him again, because when the Bahuka closed a year ago, there were a lot of qualified aquariums, including the Aquarium of the Pacific, that attempted to take the fish and give them a home for free. That was refused by the former owners. Unfortunately, just a whole lot of PR and a lot of press attention came down on the current leaseholders of the property regarding Rufus, and I think it was just a little too much too quick. So the end result is, although people in the tiki community and Lynn from Hidden LA were trying to get Damon's, the steakhouse in Glendale, to move Rufus, assuming that could be done safely, and give him a new home in Damon's, the leaseholders of the Bahuka property have decided to hang on to their fish. And they say that they're going to keep him on site while they're renovating, which is kind of dangerous for a fish. So we're crossing our fingers that Rufus is going to stick around for another, 50 years.
Really, truly, genuinely concerned about exotic fish in construction environments. That's all I'm going to say.
Fumes.
A lot... concerned.
They just get sucked right into their air filter. So please, take good care of our Rufus. He's much loved.
Kim, one of our favorite locations downtown, where Spring and Main run together at 9th, the old Roseland Dance Hall. I believe it's called the Primrose Design Building now. Yeah.
The Taxi Dance Hall. The fabulous
old,
place.
Right. It's the City Club building. That's the name it had when it got built, back in the late 20s. The top floor was the Roseland. It was one of the last taxi dance halls. It was open through the late 60s. It's now a design studio up there. You can go up, push the buzzer, go get a tour of... It looks like a dance hall. Anyway, ground floor, that building. Verve Coffee Roasters is moving in. So you can get an espresso and meditate on taxi dancers in old Los Angeles, which is, I believe, always a very good pastime, if not actually the focus of your entire life for an entire 6 months.
Why, you could even go and sit in this coffee house once it opens and read the chapter from my novel, The Kept Girl, that deals with the Loveland Ballroom, very closely based on the Roseland.
Kim, some good news from Union Station. The ticket concourse area, so that's as you walk in the main entrance to Union Station, it's on your left. It's been closed off for 28 years with a piece of what looks like period Art Deco furniture, which actually came from the set designers of the film Blade Runner, who left it.
Look good.
It looks really good, and apparently the Catalyst Group requested that they leave it there when they shot Blade Runner, because they wanted to. They thought it was nice, and it was an effective way to close off the area. That area, I guess, has just opened up, or is about.
They're restoring the ticket booth areas now, yeah. And they're going to be opening it. And there's this came from Brigham Young's blog. Some talk about little kiosks and vendors, maybe some kind of food court. So could be interesting. The other cool thing that's going on directly opposite the ticket concourse in the Union Station complex is that Harvey House, which
is... Harvey's restaurant?
Metro had this meeting, you know, to let people know what their plans were for Union Station back when they were talking about doing a lot of development, which happily was so negatively received that they've scaled back from that. And they had all these displays on all the wonderful historical stuff in Union Station, including historic Harvey's restaurant. No, the Harvey House. Essential to the development of cuisine in America and the expansion into the West and the popularization of marmalade and the Harvey girls. Come on. Have you never seen a movie? Okay, so the Harvey House with its beautiful tiles and its extraordinary little corner bar and, there's some really sexy copper in there, too, is it's for lease. So, Kate Mandolini people, are you listening? This could be a great American restaurant. Someone with a vision needs to come in there and really turn this into the instant landmark that it deserves to be.
Back in Ohio, where I come from, I've done a lot of dreaming and I traveled some, but I never thought I'd see the day on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. That's the opening.
Yeah.
That's the opening verse from the Judy Garland film, Harvey Girls.
Which everyone should go and watch right now. Go on, just hit pause. We'll wait.
Kim, let's just look ahead. We've got some events coming up. We've got a March crime lab, the Rockefeller case. Frank Girardeau, who is now a senior editor at the Pasadena Star News, is going to be talking about this intriguing case of... false identities?
Buried... fraudulent representation and murder and kidnap and you name it. This guy had it all.
It's going to be great. And usually the crime labs fall into two talks, one at the beginning, one at the end, with some workshops in the middle. The second talk, Frank's just going to talk about the most horrific crime cases he's encountered in the course of his decades as a journalist, and some of the favorite things he likes to rail against about law enforcement agencies that conduct these murder investigations. It's going to be a lot of fun. Kim, the March Salon, the March Lava Sunday Salon, is going to feature you.
Me?
Yeah, you. We're gonna, Tom Sitton is going to come talk first.
You're not Tom Sitton.
I know. Tom's going to come. He's going to talk about his favorite corrupt politicians from the county in the city of Los Angeles, 1850 to 1950.
A rogues gallery, if you will.
Very much. Then you and Paul Rogers are going to talk for the second half.
That's true. We're going to be talking about The Kept Girl, my novel of 1929 Los Angeles. And Paul did the beautiful cover art for that book. And I selected him. Well, I asked him to do the cover art. He selected himself to actually do it.
He wrote a blog post about this.
He wrote a lovely blog post about my email asking him to think about it, and he looked at my book. And I wanted him to do the cover because I had seen this extraordinary poster that he created of Angel's Flight. And it was so clearly a contemporary image, yet it drew on a lot of historical graphic styles and photographs. And I just thought, who is this L.A. artist who's going around and finding all these wonderful vintage locations and reimagining them? So he's going to talk about his creative process and how the city of Los Angeles inspires him in these architectural drawings and illustrations. And I think we're going to be following some projects all the way through with a slideshow. And I'll be talking about how I took Raymond Chandler as a young man and a cop who is perhaps the model for Philip Marlowe and inserted them into a real-life murder mystery. So come down to the Lava Salon. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Kim. Okay, we've got to keep moving. We've got to get on to the interview. So a couple things I know about the folks we're going to interview this week. I will start with Terry because I will interview him last. So Terrence Egan is an independent contractor. He is not a spokesperson for the Huntington Library or Museum or the Gardens. He's not. He's an independent contractor. His views, which are very important and interesting, do not necessarily represent those of the Huntington as an institution.
I think you've made that very clear. Terry is an independent individual speaking for himself. Is he going to say something very strange, darling?
No, he's not. Okay, I just promised the PR department that I would make that explicit. They asked me to. So, and they're all.
I think they'll be happy with.
I know. Yes. They're going to be the first ones.
Maybe you can say hi to them by name.
Nope.
Okay.
Terry is restoring the Vaubois arbors at the Huntington, in the gardens at the Huntington. These are these ferroconcrete creations which are meant to imitate oaks, ancient oaks. Really interesting. So Terry's going to give us a long discourse on their history, their restoration, the true nature of mortar, and actually some really interesting insights into the courtship of Henry and Arabella. So really, the very end, he's going to throw some stuff, put some stuff on the table, which really, I was just like, wow, that's really interesting.
This must be the reason for the disclaimer. And of course,
No.
I'm just having fun. If you enjoy Terry's interview, you can go to the Huntington Gardens when he's working, and you can watch him build these things. Yeah. He's working in the arbor. It's just extraordinary. He is so quick, and it's really like watching the hand of God to see someone make a tree. It's beautiful, very beautiful.
And he always has interesting helpers. So just go find him Monday through Friday. Don't get there too late. And our first interview, which we'll segue into now, will be Marc Chevalier. Marc is Lava Visionary of 2014. He's been given that award because he is just really damn good at what he does, and that is bringing lost Los Angeles to life. He is going to continue to talk about the corner at Sunset and Crescent Heights, which held Schwab's Pharmacy and the Crescent Heights Market. He is going to talk about his research. It's going to be a meta conversation on the methodology of historic research in Los Angeles. This is a good interview. If you ever thought, oh, I really just want to know about this building on the corner, listen to this interview. You'll have some good first steps.
And who knows? You might be the Lava Visionary of the Year 2017.
With that, Kim, let's take it away with my interview with Marc. Marc, I'm here with you. We're Greenblatt's Deli. Why don't you properly introduce yourself and tell us, because we're going to be talking about the architect that designed this building, tell us a little bit about Greenblatt's Deli.
Hi, Richard. It's good to be back. We've spoken in the past about the Oviatt building and James Oviatt. Now we've got a new twist in the LA history saga I'm going to try to present as best as I can. I'm Marc Chevalier, Los Angeles historian by passion, and we are in Greenblatt's Deli. I can tell you about the building that we're in. It was designed by Alvin Nordstrom and Milton Anderson of the firm of Nordstrom and Anderson. And they also designed the building across the street from Greenblatt's, which we'll be talking about extensively today.
Perfect. Perfect. So we're going to talk about Schwab's. We're going to talk about the corner, specifically. We're going to talk about the southeast corner of Crescent Heights and Sunset. This is the border of the city of Los Angeles and, at the time, unincorporated county of Los Angeles. County of Los Angeles. West Hollywood incorporated as a municipality in 84. Yeah. So everything we're talking about, if we should stray west into the Sunset Strip, that's unincorporated land. And I just like to put that on the table for everyone because, as always, things get interesting for law enforcement at intersections of jurisdiction. So, let's take a deep breath. Tell us about the corner.
Well, the corner, as this place was popularly named, was a misnomer. It really wasn't a corner. It was one side of one short block that went westward from the corner of Sunset Boulevard and Laurel Avenue to Sunset Boulevard and Crescent Heights Boulevard. And this one little block, as I say, the side of the block that faced Sunset Boulevard, became a Hollywood nexus. It was a place where almost everybody in the movie industry, from the top to the bottom, would meet, would congregate, would spend time having a lunch, having a coffee, getting their hair done, buying baked goods, going to the market, and especially getting their pharmaceuticals, making their phone calls, and socializing at Schwab's. Schwab's was in one section of the corner.
Perfect. Now, we're going to come back, and we're going to do installments, I think, on the history, because there's so much. But I want to get to film agents using Schwab's as their office, because that's such a great story. But before we do that, I think we should start at the beginning and talk about a love pirate. Do you want to tell us about Mrs. Paddleford and her connection to the corner?
Sure. Well, the corner, and again, we're talking about one short block, a tract of land, was developed in the early 1900s. And it was developed as a commercial and a residential tract of land. And in 1920, a woman named Mrs. Paddleford showed up with her brand new husband, Dr. Paddleford, very rich oil man. And together they bought three plots on this tract of land, and they happened to be the plots that constituted the corner. Mrs. Paddleford was one of the most notorious American women of the early 20th century, and the press and the public loved her for it. She was known as the International Love Pirate and adventuress. And what can I tell you except that she started off as a...
Oh, yeah, I think what we're going to do, because your narrative of the corner is so famous at this point, you actually did your talk. You did a talk for Lava a while back, and you actually did a series of readings to go with your talk at Grauman at the American Cinematheque. So what I think Kim is going to do is simply read the introduction, Mrs. Paddleford introducing herself to the audience at your last talk.
So Kim will be Mrs. Paddleford for a minute. I'm great with that.
Okay. I'm ready to be Mrs. Paddleford for a minute. My name is Ellen Genevieve Marion McKinney Irwin Toomey Teal Paddleford Howells Fawcett. You may address me as Mrs. Paddleford, America's international adventuress and love pirate. That's what the world's newspapers have called me for decades. I started off as a Broadway showgirl and wiped out the fortunes and reputations of three multimillionaires. I also stole the finest things from the finest shops and hotels on three continents. In between my husbands, lovers, and hundreds of unpaid bills, I was locked up at Blackwell's Island, San Quentin, and in jails across Europe, again and again.
Thank you, Kim. That was very good. Mark, I think for the sake of time in this interview, you're going to have to tell us what happens to Mrs. Paddleford, and we're going to have to move on. She's a deeply fascinating character.
Well, after Mrs. Paddleford and Dr. Paddleford bought their plots of land, they moved into a giant house on one of them, and Mrs. Paddleford became a society matron, while on the side, taking care of her multiple lovers by having them stay with her in there when her husband was out of town, and by giving them gifts from her husband's wardrobe, cufflinks, watches, that sort of thing. When Dr. Paddleford figured out what was going on, and when he started to see the mountains of unpaid bills that his wife was racking up, he filed for divorce. Mrs. Paddleford promptly escaped to Europe with her son and daughter from previous marriages, and she stole from the finest hotels and the finest shops, and was jailed in two different countries, and her husband refused to bail her out. Understandably, when she finally came back, her husband sued for divorce, and she ran off to Mexico, claiming she would commit suicide if anyone tried to bring her back. Dr. Paddleford got his divorce in absentia, and he proceeded to sell off the plots of land they held that were the corner.
Perfect. Perfect. What I want to do is I want to jump ahead. We've talked in the introduction about the architects that built the building that Schwab's cafeteria would eventually sit in. I wanna just jump into the mix, I want you to tell us about Schwab's, which moved into the drugstore space that had been developed. And I want you to give us a day in the life, 1934. Schwab's Pharmacy. Who's there? Who's dropping in? What you can do? What you can... Yeah.
I am going to give you 1 minute, if I may, about the building that was built on the corner, because it was extraordinary and it's forgotten today. In 1931, the plots of land that constituted the corner were bought by a developer who hired architects Nordstrom and Anderson to design one of the most beautiful commercial buildings in Los Angeles history. It looked like a Norman chateau, towers, walked archways you could walk through to get from place to place. It was faced in marble on all three sides. It was shimmering. It was expensive, especially for 1931. And one of the first businesses to move into this wonderful building was Schwab's. They took over a pharmacy that had been there for only a few months and had failed. And the Schwab brothers, who were all pharmacists, decided to make it the most service-oriented pharmacy in the world, at least by their reckoning. A day of the life of Schwab's meant that if you were a person of Hollywood and you were on your way to a studio or to your agent in the morning, you could stop by there at 7, get your coffee, get your prescription, read the newspaper. If it was lunchtime, you could stop by there and have one of the best counter meals that were available in the city offered to you not by a cook but by a chef. If you were a little bit out of work in the afternoon, you could stay at Schwab's and nurse your coffee while using one of its 3 telephones indoors and 2 payphones outdoors, so you wouldn't lose a call from an agent. If you were hungry in the evening, you could stop by and have your dinner there as well. You could pick up some fine liquor, fine perfumes for as a gift, and you could socialize with the movers and shakers as well as the everyday people just striving to make it in Tinseltown. It was a special place, and everyone I've spoken to or read about related to it recall it fondly.
Perfect. Perfect. We've mentioned the talk you gave at the American Cinematheque. It was in conjunction with the screening of the Charles Brackett, Billy Wilder film Sunset Boulevard. Do you just, because I think that's one of the more salient public, salient appearances on film of Schwab's, do you just want to talk about those two scenes and just what was happening there? It was all night. They go there at night, so it's really... This is an people are hanging out at the drugstore at midnight.
Well, Sunset Boulevard really wanted to capture the striving aspect of Hollywood. And they focused on Schwab's as a place for strivers, for the people who were waiting for the gravy train, to quote William Holden from the film. It was a revealing look because almost none of America knew what Schwab's was. Billy Wilder wanted to add a note of truth to the film. I think it was a somewhat negative portrayal because you really can't see that in the film that Schwab's was considered to be a positive place by people who went there. It wasn't simply a waiting room. It was a place to find comfort. It was a place to have friendship. It was a place to receive quality goods and quality services. A home away from home, as it were.
Perfect. I want to start to look to the end of Schwab's. I know that the Schwab brothers made a decision that there was going to be a remodel and a reinvention of what Schwab's was. And in addition to that, there's the architect John Lautner comes into play. And if you could just sort of start to take us into the decline of Schwab's and what its final chapters look like.
Well, a number of things come into play here. Googie's Coffee Shop, mid-century modern architecture, Schwab's competition and desire to expand, and the decline of the old Hollywood system. In 1949, Googie's Coffee Shop was built, really as a lean-to, right next to Schwab's, and it was completely different. It was mid-century modern, what we call Googie's architecture, an anomaly. Well, by 1955, the anomaly had become the norm for West Hollywood, and mid-century modern had conquered the hillsides and the commercial areas. Suddenly, this beautiful Norman castle that was the building of the corner seemed to be outdated. So the owner of the building decided to remodel it. He tore off the tower, he tore down the archway, he tore off everything that looked like a chateau, and he essentially made the east and west wings of the building look like two pink stucco boxes with a few windows. Unrecognizable from what it was. Schwab's took advantage of the outside remodel of the building to remodel their interior and expand. They turned to John Lautner, an African-American architect who was one of the first to be able to cross over into the white world, you could say, and be successful at it professionally. Lautner designed the interior of Google's to be mid-century modern, and he did a beautiful job of it. It was extraordinarily well done, far better than the exterior, I think, which were designed by someone else. If you've ever been to Cantor's Deli, the interior of Cantor's was also designed by John Lautner right around the same time. And that still exists, although Schwab's itself is long gone. The decline, well, Schwab's continued to be a haven for Hollywood set, but fewer and fewer strivers came. A few of the older stars, a few of the newer stars, but it was no longer a hangout as it was years before, and that's because the studio system had disappeared and Hollywood had divided in quite a bit. Finally, in 1983, the Schwab brothers decided to close shop forever. It was bittersweet. There were stars that would drive by afterward and not even be able to look at the building because they felt so sad that it was gone, or that Schwab's was gone from it. And in 1988, the whole building itself was finally demolished. By then, almost nobody had remembered that it had been a Norman castle. It was simply stucco box.
Perfect. We're going to wrap this up today. So we're just across the street. What is there today? Just so people get what it is we're talking about.
There's a 1990s small structure, about, I'd say, 3.5 stories high. It's supposed to be Italian Renaissance, I've been told. It's more a blocky Lego version of Italian Renaissance. It does have a tower, and I've long wondered whether that was done in homage of the much earlier building. But I don't know. We've got a Trader Joe's, we've got a Crunch Gymnasium, we've got a couple of furniture stores, and a movie theater, right? The Sundance Theaters, I believe. And that's what we have, but it's really nothing like what was there from 1931 to 1955, or after the remodel, 1955 to 1988.
Perfect. I want to wrap this up. I know there's a lot people don't know about Schwab's, but I want you to tell us one anecdote about about Schwab's that you want people to know that hasn't fit into the narrative that I've let you spin for us.
I'll tell you one that's a little surprising probably to many people. Schwab's had its own twin next door. I should say spiritual twin, because they weren't related in a business way. And its Schwab's spiritual twin was a grocery market. Market next door to Schwab's in the Norman Castle building. was called the Crescent Heights Market, and from the late 30s through the late 50s, or sorry, the late 40s, was owned by the crankiest man on earth, by his own admission, is Sam Rubin. He started off in the 20s as a car seat upholsterer, and by the 30s he was a Brooklyn nightclub promoter, got tired of the mob, and came to Los Angeles in the late 30s with a wad of cash. He immediately bought this grocery market in the corner. Nobody knew why, including himself. And he not only owned it, but he managed it day in, day out. The goods that he sold did not have price tags. He would call out the prices as you were buying them at the checkout counter. If you were cranky yourself, or you were snotty, or you seemed rich, the higher the price you would pay. Sam Rubin had a lot of the Schwab's regulars go over to his market and hang out there when they tired of Schwab's. A lot of Strivers, a lot of out-of-work actors, and a lot of big stars, too, between movie deals. You had Bob Mitchum, already a star. He would work there as a stock boy just for fun. And you would have other stars work at the checkout counters. Again, they would be doing it for fun, just playing around. There were parties there. Sometimes starlets would get up on the checkout counters and start to dance just to annoy Sam Rubin. And they did. Old actor Wallace Beery liked to start eating the fruit before he would buy it, and that really got Sam Rubin's goat as well. In other words, it was a party in a grocery store, and Schwab's and the Crescent Heights Market, I think, were the true brother and sister of the corner.
Mark, thank you. You've done a wonderful job bringing us up to speed. We're going to come back, and we're going to dig in and dig into earlier periods and give them a little more time, but thank you for giving us this important overview of the corner.
I'm always, always happy to do this. Thank you so much.
My name is Carolyn Paxton. I'm in Urban Radish here in the downtown LA Arts District, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Terry, I'm here with you. We're at the Huntington. We're in the middle of the Rose Garden. And I want you to properly introduce yourself and briefly tell us what it is you're doing. And then we'll, once we briefly understand this, we'll roll up our sleeves and get deep into it.
Okay. I'm Terry Egan. I'm working on a collection of 100 concrete trees that were built in Mr. Huntington's time. The concrete trees are decaying because of the way they were built. And I'm doing not just making them look good, I'm remedying the problem that makes them decay so that if my theories are correct, 90 years from now, they're 90 years old. 90 years from now, they're just going to be looking for the spots that I missed.
Perfect. Okay. First and foremost, let's get the original proper name of these structures that you're restoring.
Okay. Well, the craft is called faux bois, French for false wood. Now, I got curious. I had to know, why French? Is there a reason that it's French? Is there something to it that's more than it just sounds better? And if that's the case, well, why French? Fake wood would sound better in any language. So why French? Well, here's what I learned. Reinforced concrete was invented in France. And our oldest reinforced concrete bridge is made to look like rustic logs and timbers as it crosses a moat to a stone castle. Now, Joseph Monnier is a garden designer, and in 1875, he's expanding his patents to include bridges. He builds his very first bridge to look as if the peasants of another era made it for that chateau. Now, when I learned that, I thought, well, that's fascinating stuff. We should all know this. And even before Joseph Monnier gets this patent for his bridges, even before that, if we keep going further back into this, we learn that what began as reinforced concrete was garden craftsmen building rock. It's easier to make a rock than it is to move it. And with the invention of chicken wire in Britain in 1844, these crates are showing up on the mainland carrying no less than chickens. and it becomes an armature for what this plastic material can do. So the very first experiments are planters, troughs, water containers, ways to bring in their citrus trees because it freezes there. Right. Now, in 1860s, it starts turning into infrastructure for Paris. And one of the oldest examples of faux bois that we have in a public area still there is Parc Bout-Chaumont. Now, my French isn't great. I think that's how we pronounce it. Parc Bout-Chaumont is a mountain of stone brought to the site of a rock quarry, and it's all unified to look like the same type of stone. With the Portland cement that they're getting from Britain, it's superior to anything they've used before. They can unify all the strata of the rock that they're bringing to this site to look like one type of stone. Now, one of these craftsmen that's working on this thing, they get this idea, well, let's make a cavern inside with like a grotto or have a waterfall flow into it. And he's taking poultry netting, a.k.a. chicken wire, barrel bands, and iron rods and creates stalactites hanging from the ceiling of this cavern with mortar. And then it goes from there to making stuff look like wood. So the pathway that leads to the top of this viewpoint of Paris in 1867 is faux bois. Faux bois handrails, faux bois stair treads, a footbridge that leads to the top of this viewpoint of Paris for an exposition in 1867.
And I don't want to, because I want to move on and get into the work here, but I don't want you to forget the concrete, reinforced concrete boat.
Oh, yes. Now, the concrete boat is probably what we know is that the very first patents for anything like this were obtained by a guy who was one of these gentlemen farmers. And he, as I was mentioning, gets these poultry netting, chicken wire cages, like crates, brought to his doorstep. And he's got this brilliant idea. Well, that's maybe what I've been looking for his armatures to create pots and planters and cisterns. He gets his first patents in Belgium instead of France, so it doesn't help him. And when they get to the first exposition in 1855, instead of bringing pots, planters, and cisterns, which everybody would want, he brings a concrete rowboat. Now, it's completely overlooked by everybody at this exposition of industry and agriculture, except by this other guy who's in charge of the Tuileries orangery, the orange trees at the Tuileries gardens. So Joseph Monnier sees his concrete boat, gets this idea that's what I need. I need to make these pots so I can bring in the citrus trees. He gets his first patents in France this time in the 1860s for pots, planters, and cisterns, superseding the patents that were of Joseph Louis Lambeau, the boat builder. So what we know of Lambeau is that he wasn't as ambitious as Monnier. He's a gentleman farmer. He shows his boat because he's proud of it and ends up living his life on his ranch or farm, and he's seen rowing his boat, and the boat disappears for almost a century and is dug up out of this lake. And sometime, I think it was in the 70s or something, it was dug up, and it becomes this whole new cause celeb of making ferro concrete sailing ships.
I love it.
So when you look up ferro concrete, F-E-R-R-O, in Wikipedia, you see these guys talking about their concrete sailing ships that they can build in their backyard now.
Okay, good. I think we're ready to roll up our sleeves and jump into the work at hand you have. So we're here at the Huntington. It's gorgeous. We're in this pergolate area. So tell us a little bit about your workspace, and then let's just get into what it is you're doing.
Okay. Well, the workspace is just a kind of a temporary shelter. It's a kind of a gypsy camp. Everything's out of context here. Most people, when they come by to visit and see what I'm doing, don't actually see what I'm doing. They see these odd 2x3 structures that don't look like scaffolding but actually function as my scaffold. And they'll walk up to me while I'm mixing something and they'll say, well, what are you doing? I'm saying, well, I'm making a mess. Or, I play every day like improv. I have to. And then I'll say, well, I'm mixing concrete. And they go, well, concrete, what's that for? Well, I'm working on sculpture. And we're standing in between one of these concrete trees when they're saying this. And I say, well, I'm working on sculpture. And they'll say, well, where's the sculpture? They don't even see them. In fact, the point of the collection, I think, is that they disappear. You don't see them as trees. You don't see them as sculpture. You're just in the gardens as part of nature. They're so realistic that you just ignore them completely, which is really probably the point of the whole thing, is that they don't glare out at you as like a collection of 100 sculptures lined up in a row.
Perfect. Let's, before, and we're just keep getting, of course, drawn back to the work at hand, but yep. Before we get into the work and the restoration, I want you to describe a little bit more of your workspace, the tools you use, and just if, because this is a podcast, people can't see it, so what does your basic toolkit here consist of?
Well, the favorite tools that I have are kitchen tools, like a pastry bag loaded with mortar, a butter knife, a baby fork, a cut-off piece of a nylon scrub brush, and my favorite tool of all is a roofing nail. Now, the roofing nail was a huge discovery for me. It was probably the biggest discovery of the whole project. How do I get my work to match the original master's bark? The bark on these trees have this very raggedy edge, very natural-looking. They're very realistic, more realistic than I've ever seen any faux bois ever. And when I discovered this collection, that was the first thing that struck me, because I've been looking at stuff like this my whole life. And when I saw this collection, the first thing that struck me is, gosh, there's a lot of it. There's 100 of these trees. I didn't count it then. But the first thing that really struck me is how good this guy was at it, that he has this very realistic style. Now, getting further into it, I learned that we actually have two people that worked on it originally, but we don't have their names. Their names were never recorded. They were just on staff at the Huntington at the time that he lived here. And we've got 85 of the 100 trees that have this very realistic style. Then there's 15 trees in the original collection of a more simplified, more primitive, more crude, we'll call it folk craft style, which is more likely how you see faux bois. More often than not, when you see it, you can see somebody's hand was involved in it. You don't mistake it for a tree. It's obvious that somebody built this thing. Whereas these other guys that are so realistic, you don't even think of it in terms of somebody's hand. It's just nature. So the interesting thing here with this project is that because we have no names for either one of them, I don't have to preserve the apprentice's work. I don't have to make my patches match the apprentice. I can now, since I figured out how he does his bark, the master's bark, I can make new versions of the master's bark over the top of the apprentice's trees. In other words, we're making old growth versions using the apprentice's work as armature. And the old growth versions are a little bit bigger, a little bit more gnarly. I can be as maverick as I like. And as long as I've got that type of bark, it'll always match the master's trees. We'll call it cementus fullerandus.
Okay. I want to get back to your tools. I just, okay. I want to leave the tools eventually, but I still don't right. think we've given people a really good sense of the tools you work with. And just to get it straight, a roofing nail is a short nail with a very wide head. Right. If people are thinking of 20 penny or 5 penny nails, the finished nails that are thin,
the size of the nail wouldn't all that much matter. It's just that particular nail was the easiest one for me to pick up and gave me the best match to what the master's nail was, just given the size of the grooves in these pieces of bark. And by pushing the head of the nail through the surface, after I strike the surface first with a stiff brush, dragging the stiff brush, it puts fine grain to it, then pushing the head of the nail below that surface, and as I push it up through the surface, it will push material out of the way like a little plow, and it leaves these ragged edges that I can't do deliberately, which is what makes it so much more like nature, is because it's not a deliberate, I'm not anticipating every move. I'm just like moving through the stuff, and as it begins to look like wood, I figure out when to leave it alone. It becomes wood as I work with it, rather than something more intentionally sculpted. It's improv in 3D.
I love it. I want to talk about the bucket of ice water that's always next to you, because at this point we really need to get into curing times and the nature, the plastic nature of the limited window of the plastic nature of cement.
Well, the material I'm working with is a very fast-curing material. It's fast-curing. It's extremely hard, extremely strong. It's actually called Rapid Set for a reason. And it sets so rapidly that most people can't work with it. Now, I've discovered that if I make my batch, load it into the pastry bags, then drop the pastry bags into a bucket of ice water, the pastry bag thinks it's winter, almost freezing. So the chemical reaction is slowed down to such a degree that it doesn't actually start happening until I pull it out of the water and start working with it. And then it'll cure up and get hard within, say, 20, 30 minutes. Well, not hard, but hard enough. Hard enough to actually start carving and doing more detailed work, more subtractive work that's more like the average sculptor was working with it. But the sculpting that I'm doing is a much more plastic. It's much more like decorating a cake with mortar instead of icing. And that's what's giving me the best match to the way the master did it originally.
Perfect. I want to, at this point, think we've got, can we walk over to a patch here? Let's walk over to a patch, yeah, right here. So I think the best way to start to talk about how you lay down your materials, why don't you describe to us what we're looking at here? Go ahead.
Okay, well, let's get into what makes it decay, because it's kind of obvious when I start describing what you're looking at here. The way that these were built originally, late teens, early 20s, they'd start with a single iron rod, the rebar, in a hole in the ground. They'd place a bunch of concrete around that to hold it vertical. Then they would surround that with these baskets of mesh. These cages of expanded steel are surrounding that rebar and held in place by wires. Well, that's their concrete form. Unlike the forms that we have today, an open mesh form like that, a basket, you'd have to have a very stiff, dry mix of concrete to go into it so you can stack it on top of itself. You're not using a fluid pour, and there's not so much pressure against the sides of the basket that makes it want to come apart. That's why our forms today are much more robust, much stronger. They're solid-skinned plywood or cardboard tube, or they're designed to take a fluid mixture. The reason for that is that it doesn't leave air pockets inside. What's happened here is because of that very dry mix, they're stacking these dry mixes into it. They're not tamping it down. They're not using a fluid pour, so it's ending up leaving these air pockets behind. Now, over the course of 90 years, the air pockets become pools of water as it absorbs moisture. Those pools of water then, if they can stay there long enough, rust the steel. So the other thing that's happening here, and why you see some of it decaying and some of it that's not decaying, the rest of that science lesson, as it's drying out, it's carrying with it the finest minerals from inside, the calcium carbonate, the flowstone, something like a stalagmite material, is coming out with the moisture. And now that's coated all the steel I can't get to. So as I tap at a surface, listening for the hollow sound, that's how we get that material, sound, that expression, sound material is what sounds right. That's what goes forward in time without my help. What I leave behind is sound material hasn't failed in 90 years. So by finding everything that's sound material, getting to that point where it's at its stasis, at its equilibrium, after 90 years, some of it's failed and some of it hasn't. The part that's failed I've removed, exposing the stuff that's been rusting. Now I treat the rusting metal that's been exposed with techniques from the auto body trade. Phosphoric acid converts the iron oxides to iron phosphates and makes it arrested. And then a cold galvanizing etching primer goes in and adds zinc to the steel. Now the steel under my new work won't rust. So at that point, I've corrected the rusting steel problem. I add a new layer of mesh in these jigsaw puzzle shapes of what's missing. The layer of mesh is held in place with a building adhesive until my mortar can take over. I push mortar into that mesh with a heavy scrub brush. I beat it with a heavy scrub brush, pushes it into all the nooks and crannies. Now I've eliminated the rusting steel and the air pockets problem that would make my material rust, giving myself this rough texture, kind of like a stucco surface. It's a mechanical bond then for my last layer that gets sculpted.
Perfect. And let's then walk over to the workbench over here, which is a work in progress of this final layer, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Great, perfect. So now we're going to walk over. You're building something. You're building a little something, and we'll leave it. We'll tell us what it. So we're here. We're at the final, the surface layer.
Yeah.
And why don't you explain to us then the work that is done to get the technique and the look and the feel of the master's work?
Well, first having a piece of scrub brush dragged through the surface, putting these fine striations in it, like you're combing the surface, I'll make waves with that, and that will indicate the direction of grain that, say, the bark is going. Once I have that, then I'll take the head of the roofing nail and push it through the surface to get this ragged edge look, and then it starts looking a lot more like this master's yeah. style of bark. And because the material is so sticky, there's an acrylic admixture in here that I use that, instead of using water, I'm using something like you'd use to set tile.
Right.
And that acrylic admixture makes my material absorb moisture at a slower rate, and so that as the moisture is flowing out, it's wanting to flow out the old work instead of the new work. So it's continuing that process of helping it to heal by collecting all of that calcium carbonate in the old work. It's pushing out all the moisture through the old work first.
So this is fantastic. Tell us, there's a section here that's a section the bark has pulled away and you've just gotten the raw wood. Do you want to just tell us? I just watched you do this before we started to interview you. It's gorgeous. Tell us what this is.
Well, the way that the master did his work and what characterizes it from this apprentice's work is he's leaving places where the bark has come away and the tree has tried to heal itself. And there's places where branches have been broken off. Some of this place where their bark isn't has got knots and swirls and character that would show the inside structure of a tree. So I've taken his inspiration of those places of knot bark and continued that. Now I have his bark. I've got his bark down. I figured out how he does his bark. I can go as maverick as I like in these knots and swirls, and I'll always have his species of tree. So I've taken that off in those directions, and I try not to outshine his work, but be inspired by it.
Perfect. And I think we've got one. We've got a little friend over here. Oh, you're going to tell us about
this little cat. Is a concrete cat. Now, when people don't understand that it's sculpture, it gives me an opportunity to say, well, you know, it's not too much different than the cat. And they can see that the cat is concrete. And so they can get that connection. Oh, the trees are sculpture. They're not trees. Is there a tree inside? No, there's not a tree inside. They've never been a tree. They've always been sculpture.
Is there a cat inside?
There's not a cat inside. The story with the cat, though, is that I found him in a vacant lot. And his ears were broken. And I'm thinking, I know somebody that can fix that. I should bring him here and test my product on him. Yeah. So I brought him here. I fixed his ears. And, you know, you save an alley cat, they never go away. They're stuck with you forever. That's Henry. Henry Edwards House Cat. I had to name him after our benefactor here. He always wanted to have a home. Now he's got a home. Henry Edwards House Cat. Had to give him the same initials.
Terry, do you want to just... Do you want to just tell us briefly, if you can, about the foreman that was in charge of this garden, that supervised the creation of these foie gras pergolas and all of this gorgeous hardscape that is complemented by the incredibly gorgeous landscape?
Right. Well, when Huntington started this property, it was already started. He bought it as a working ranch. And it was a Victorian mansion on the property. And he bought this working ranch. He brought in a guy to be his supervisor. And this guy is, by any stretch of the, you know, our modern lexicon, he's a masterful landscape designer, landscape architect. They call him the supervisor. I'm not sure why. But he was Henry's supervisor, because he managed everything here, including the staff of the house, the staff of the library, the staff of the art collections, how to unload the trucks, how to unload the trains that actually would arrive with his art. and designed these gardens. Now, here's a thing that I like to do, is to put this collection of faux bois in context. Because if we stop to think about the context of Mr. Huntington and the time that he lived, the most popular entertainer of the age, of the time that he was here and doing this, Will Rogers,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Making more money than Charlie Chaplin, yeah, in the late teens, early 20s. So rustic is going to be part of everybody's lexicon. Now, when Henry is trying to woo Arabella, who is Uncle Collis's first wife, but she's Henry's age, he's wooing her, she's the richest woman in the world, because Collis split his fortune between Henry, Arabella, and their adopted son, Archer. Now, when he is trying to woo the richest woman in the world, but she's, you know, because he's known her as long as Collis has known her, they're starting to talk about the mansion that they'll have for these collections of art that she's collecting. And she doesn't want to leave New York. She'd rather be in New York with her art collecting scene and her socializing. It's either New York or Paris for her. But how's he going to get her to the boonies of Southern California? This is the outback as far as she's concerned. He builds her a Japanese garden in 1912. And he uses rustic oak harvested off the property to create rustic arbors overlooking the gardens and lead from the mansion. Now, this is me connecting the dots. We don't have records for this. We don't know. But that's when he proposes to her and she accepts that proposal. I mean, he's been proposing to her for a while. But this is when she finally accepts the proposal. They leave for France to get married. Now, this is me again connecting the dots. They're walking through the gardens of Paris. Henry, look at this stuff. It's all the rage in Paris. But when they see it, it's already 50 years old. It's been in Paris for a long time. But now, his rustic thing, his own rustic aesthetic, has Arabella's stamp of approval. It's found in France. Now, Collis, Uncle Collis, dies at the first of the Adirondack's grand camps built by William Durant in the upper state New York. So those rustic lodges, the rustic aesthetic, or these rustic arbors, probably reminded him of his Uncle Collis, his beloved Uncle Collis. He spent his whole life with Collis. And so, in my mind, the collection could be more personal to Mr. Huntington than anything else in the gardens that's sculpture, because it wasn't purchased through his art dealer. It's just something he wanted. It's here because he wanted it. It's not here because the dealer said, well, you know, if you're going to have a collection of world-class sculpture, you need one of these. It's because he wanted it.
Terry, you did it. I want to thank you. That was a great tie-in. You've done a great job explaining all this wonderful work that you've done. You're here in the Rose Garden. I want you, you have a website. Before we go, I want you quickly to tell us about just this, the URL. We'll post it on the webpage, because people want to know more about the work you do and the history of this place.
Right. Well, the website, fauxboisconcrete.info, was set up for me by my intern the first summer I was here. The intern came from Scripps University in Claremont. It was their first year of art conservation, the first year of art conservation course. They're coming through here touring the gardens. They were actually looking for an internship for her, or for their group, in the library, because they have a conservation lab. So they're walking through the gardens. They see this collection, and about a month later or so, I get this call. Would you like an intern? I said, well, yeah, that'd be great. She could help me talk to people, because a lot of my time is spent talking. Now, when she comes on board, her mission is to document the project. And I say, I don't have 21st century skills. She's obviously got them. I mean, she's a kid. So the first thing I had her do was set up this website. And she goes to Weebly. About 2 weeks later, we've got this website up and running. I've just been tweaking it ever since. I owe Aaron a huge thank you. And if you see the website and you go to the various pages, I always tell people to go to those history pages first, because those Wikipedia links are so interesting. But we set it up in a way that you can see how the project is done, see and have this explanation of why they decay, how I'm saving the work, and learn how to do it. There's enough information there to do it yourself if you're interested. And then there's the biography page, and instead of me going into some long essay of what my bio is, I just said, well, how about you ask me questions and I can answer them? That's a lot easier for me to deal with.
Perfect. So we're gonna sign off, and if people start building a giant oak in their backyard with a 6-foot diameter trunk, can they come ask you for tips on stabilization?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Terry, I want to thank you for your time, and we hope to have you back.
Yeah, I say this on the website, you know, a lost art is only lost for the people that don't want to learn it.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
My name is Stephen G., and I'm here in the Los Angeles Athletic Club, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our podcast for the week of February 24th, 2014. Our guests this week were Marc Chevalier, who is the great historian of Los Angeles and lava visionary of 2014, and Terry Egan. He is an independent contractor restoring the faux bois arbors at the Huntington. Kim, this is the point in our podcast where I ask you to let people know, or remind them, I hope, because I hope a lot of people have been listening for a while. Just remind or let them know how they can give us feedback, because we like feedback, and we like iTunes feedback.
Yeah, but, you know, no one does that. So I could go into how it would be nice if you gave us a rating on iTunes, but all of our listeners have heard this a million times. You know the drill. If you listen to iTunes, give us a rating. Okay. You can send us an email. youcaneatthesunshine@gmail.com. You can send an email through the esoteric.com contact link. You can come to an esoteric bus adventure or a free or paid lava event and let us know that you're enjoying the podcast. We always love to hear from our listeners. Thank you.
All right, Kim, let's do this. We're in the home stretch. Let's let everyone know about some upcoming bus tours. I'm going to take the first couple. You'll take the last couple. We're gonna bring this podcast on home. Are you ready?
Yeah, go.
Okay. This Saturday, March 1. I can't believe it's March already.
Well, it's not quite yet. But
it's almost. Yeah. March 1, Hotel Horrors, Main Street Vice. This is an unhinged look at crime, vice, and single room occupancy hotels in downtown Los Angeles from about... Oh, we go back. We have 19th century crimes on this tour. We have last year's crimes on this tour. It is the gamut. We run the gamut. We cover everything: B-girls, serial killers, taxi dance halls.
I wish I could find a story about a B-girl who was a serial killer. I wonder if there ever was a B-girl who was not in Los Angeles. I'd have found her by now.
Weekend after, 2 weekends after that, March 15th, Pasadena Confidential with Crimebo, the crime clown. Rocket scientists who are black magicians, who swap wives, who consort with Lafayette Roland Hubbard and conjure the Babylon working.
That's just one of the wacky people you'll meet on this tour.
Poorly behaved owners of primates and even more poorly behaved younger siblings who decide to take out their frustrations on the rest of their families. Never live in Pasadena if you're called Judd. Kim?
Richard?
March 22, Weird West Adams. Racial housing covenants. Kidnappings? No serial killers.
A lot of kidnappings.
No serial killers.
Beautiful cemetery walk. Explosions.
Nearly child brides.
Tar pits that claim children. So many fun things over in West Adams.
Red car safety. Basic Pacific Electric red car safety guidelines.
Bank robberies.
Yeah.
You name it. It's a crime bus tour.
Kim, I'm going to let you bring us home with the last two.
All right, I can do that. Hey, it's 20 years since Charles Bukowski died in March. Did you know that? Yeah. You did know that because the journalists have been calling us nonstop, like from Denmark and what have you. It's true. March 9th is the anniversary of Bukowski's death, but there was some half marathon in Hollywood. So we're giving our Bukowski tour a little later than that. March 29th, Haunts of a Dirty Old Man, Charles Bukowski's Los Angeles, following in his steps as he transitions from manual laborer, completely incompetent postal worker to internationally acclaimed poet and novelist and raconteur and still, I believe, the most shoplifted author in American history. So if you want to know how it all happened and how it can happen to you at the age of 50 plus, get on that bus.
We're, no, Kim, you almost forgot.
What?
He wasn't incompetent as a postal worker because he wasn't a good postal worker. He was incompetent because he failed to do what every other single civil servant in the post office did, which was ask help of their friends.
Yes, yes. And that's an interesting insight, Richard, that you've picked up from... I think you are the only person who is a sort of biographer. I mean, you're a biographer of Bukowski. You just happen to do it as a bus tour. You're the only biographer of Bukowski that I know of who spent a lot of time with Angeleno postal workers asking for their opinions on post office. And I appreciate that.
More importantly, I've spent time interviewing postal workers who worked in Terminal Annex.
Where Bukowski worked. So, yeah. And then in April 5th, we're back on the bus with our most popular crime bus tour, The Real Black Dahlia. And if you've been wanting to check out the Esoteric Bus and see what we're all about, you could do a lot worse than to get on that bus because it's a really wild ride back in time to 1946-47 and a fascinating murder investigation in what remains to this day perhaps the most famous unsolved murder in American history, Black Dahlia case.
Okay. I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to listen, and I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long lost neighborhood called Herman between South Pass and Highland Park. Gold mine.